buts and if you please. Dreams may be good. Life can be better than you dream. No one should be smell a chance, have a nice dinner party with folks you just met. Take a drawing lesson, learn the new math, throw oatmeal and rose water in your bath. Grab every greasy moment you can get. Life meant for living, love meant for giving. No more buts and if and if you please. Let's burn it up and move along. Time to sing a whole new kind of song. Time to see a sky of blue, not gray, not rain.
You're listening to Speaking of Music, a show by and about musicians. I'm Barry Livingston. Today our in-studio guest is Toronto-based singer-songwriter Michelle Rumble. I've known Michelle and her music for over 30 years, and full disclosure, I'm a huge fan. Michelle has one of the most beautiful and distinctive voices on the Canadian music scene. In the late 1980s, Michelle co-founded the excellent band Grievous Angels and made several amazing albums with them, including Toute la Gang and One Job Town. Michelle also lived in New Orleans and participated in the music scene there for a couple of years, and in 2019 put out her most recent recording, Years Behind. Michelle, welcome to the show, and thanks so much for coming in all the way from Toronto.
Thank you, Barry. Happy to be here.
Yeah, well, it's great to see you after all this time. Speaking of time, to begin, I'd like to go back quite a bit to when you were a child, and if you can recall any of your hopefully positive earliest musical or singing memories, and what drew you to music in the first place.
Oh, that's really easy. My mom was my dad was a drummer, like a drum corps drummer. At his high school, De La Salle in Toronto. So that's the rhythm side covered. And my mother and her siblings, two sisters and a brother, had a group called the Four Rassicos. So they would go around Northern Ontario singing at dance halls and radio stations. And they were doing like classic four-part harmony. So think Ink Spots and Andrew Sisters, and Sentimental Journey was a huge song growing up. So I always was hearing great songwriting, great classic sort of pop, American songbook pop music, all that stuff, from when I was very, very little. And family parties up north were awesome and full of lots of music. I have a lot of musician cousins. So that's super positive from a direct family place. And then my big voices when I was really young were Judy Garland, and then sort of Barbara Streisand but Billie Holiday were kind of the biggest ones between my, up to my like teens, I guess.
That's amazing, because they were really like songbook singers to some extent, and more coming out of more of a traditional singing mode versus like a rock singing kind of thing.
Yeah, that was my whole background. It was about singing, and I was really into theater and show tunes and all of that. Like, that's what I really sang until I started singing in church, which is a classic sort of thing. In my teens, like 14, I started singing in a Catholic folk group, which in the 70s was a groovy thing. And that's kind of when folk music came onto the scene for me. And because in the 70s, Catholic scene was all like, well, it turns out covering like 60s stuff. Like, what did we do? We do like, there's a new world somewhere, they call, like all these. All those songs, those super hopeful songs. But so they were trying to sort of undo the seriousness of the Latin Mass and the heavy duty music. I love all of that old liturgical stuff and the folk singing that I did. So that's it's a good background for a singer to have, any kind of church singing.
It's amazing. It's really diverse, like a lot of different kinds of music there.
Yeah, totally. Not gospel, not much gospel. Okay. That's the only thing. So when gospel started waking me up, in so many different ways in terms of freedom, of like the free voice. And that was a huge thing for me in terms of like following who I am and who I was then.
You grew up north of Timmins?
No, my mom is from up there. Okay, I'm a Scarborough girl.
Oh, really? Mm. Oh, okay. Well, there you go. I learned something here.
Yeah. I think, Steve Fruitman is the villain here. And I say that with love. Okay. Steve has perpetuated the mythology just because Timmins is a huge part of he and my connection. But I was not born in Timmins. My mother wasn't even born. She was born in Connaught, of this really small town outside of Timmins.
Okay. Yeah. And so what's the Timmins connection there? His grandparents were there.
Yeah. And all my relatives are up there. All my mom's siblings. And then Steve Fruitman, his family name is Feldman, and there was a Feldman Lumber. And Steve was along, I don't know what was happening. We were up north. Maybe it was on the train trip when we tried to save the rails in the 80s. I don't remember, frankly. But somehow Steve and I got to talking about the north and Timmins, and we realized that my aunt and uncle owned the house that his grandparents owned and he had grown up in. And I know he has told that story several times, as I have. And for me, the thing was when we figured out, I said, was there a laundry chute? And he said, yes, there was a laundry chute. Like, who has a laundry chute? But that was always this really weird, scary thing about this big, beautiful house that they still own. I still go up. For me, a trip to Timmins isn't real until I've gone to that house. So,
and there's a big laundry chute in the house that was actually used for laundry.
Yes. Yeah. Still is. Wow. Anyway, that's the connection.
Were there any bands or music ensembles that you were a part of in school that maybe had an influence on your trajectory as well?
Not really part of, I was a choir singer mostly, and then I did musical theater. That was kind of it. What affected the trajectory was the band L'Etranger, because I went to Notre Dame, and Andrew Cash went to Neil McNeil, and so did Pete Duffin. And then Chuck was a friend of theirs. And they had this band called L'Etranger, and my brother and I really liked them, and we would go see them in all sorts of places. Like, I'm talking Peterborough, we'd follow them. And I think what happened for me watching L'Etranger was that I understood that music could be, I mean, I understood folk music, I understood message music, but that really great hard rock and music or punk music could be used to also send messages. And it was like so cool to be in a room with someone I knew who really believed their message and watch them deliver it in a really entertaining, connecting, hard-hitting way. So I loved L'Etranger. So I became very good friends with Pete, with Andrew, with Chuck. And that's why eventually Chuck and I started figuring out some music together. And then Chuck and I started that. Peter Gillard was in on it really early too, because we were kind of a trio for a bit. And then when we wanted to create a rhythm section or grow that part of it, Pete Duffin was a natural choice. And Tim Hadley, I forget how we got him. I think he was a friend of Peter's.
Can you remember writing your first songs and when that was and what that experience was like for you?
I can give two time zones, because I wrote poetry in high school. I wrote, when I was a kid, I would rewrite lyrics. I wrote poems. I wrote goofy songs that I'd sing around. I feel imbued with the idea that I was a singer. I was a poet. I didn't have people around me, didn't have mentors around me until much later. I'm going to talk about Willie P. Bennett later. I had no one to encourage me along that road other than school, some teachers or what have you. So I have things that I wrote like my 1 year of university. But I will tell you that when I was living in New Orleans, so I had been in a band for 5 years, a band in which the Grievous Angels, obviously, I did not play guitar on stage. I didn't write songs, wasn't feeling empowered to do so, didn't feel like I had a voice in ultimately at the end of the day. And then when I left them in 91, if you flash ahead to 93, when I moved to New Orleans, I actually have in my journal, I wrote a song in the following summer, I guess, or summer of 95 when I was in New Orleans. And it's called City, Lullaby for a City. It's on my first record. It's on Terrain. And it just kind of came out in 10 minutes. It's complete. It was done fully. I've only written another one like that in terms of speed. And it's very delightful when that happens. It's not the case with a lot of my other writing. But I do remember feeling, that's what a song is. Like, that's what a song for me feels like. I wonder if there are more of them.
Do you have a certain process that you use when you're sitting down to write a song, or is it kind of different for each one?
Kind of different for each one, and it really depends. I literally finished a song this week, a very quick song, because I was walking home and a little kid in a like toddler child was upset, and he was cold. I mean, it was been darn cold, and I looked at the mom. I teach in daycares. I teach music in daycares with the 0 to 4 set, so I have a connection to them. And so I started doing this little melody, and I liked it, threw it on my iPhone, like threw it on the memos. And then I ran it. I walked and talked to her, and I said, look, I don't know. I just got this little melody. She said, yeah, I heard you. So I connected with her, and I said, listen, I'll just send you this if I like it. So I took the melody home. And yesterday morning I finished. It's just a quick verse, but it's just a little song about, you know, being okay in the winter. I can't sing it right now because it's too new. I don't remember it. So that's just like I had the tune. I threw the words on it. Sometimes it works the other way around. Sometimes it's a poem that becomes a song.
That's amazing. It's great when things come quickly like that, too.
Yeah.
I'd like to go back a bit again. So you talked about initially the music scene. Well, you talked about the Grievous Angels. I'd like to get into that a bit. But there was a whole music scene happening around that band and other bands at the time. Did you just kind of jump right into that whole scene at the time, or did it take you a little while to kind of acclimatize and get into it?
Well, I don't think when you're in your 20s you think at all that way. We didn't. We just thought the advantage of having everyone else in the band had bands before, so they had some idea of how to move ahead. So that was great. So they might have been thinking more about that. For me, my general feeling was just we were doing something we loved doing. We wanted to do it for more people. But we were also doing something that we knew didn't really exist. You know, we were singing Canadian music. We were singing folk. Well, we were singing acoustic folk music when that title didn't exist. Like you would go to Sam the Record Man, Sam the Record Man, and there wasn't a slot for acoustic roots. That just phrase wasn't how we thought about music, right? So what we were doing by standing on stage and playing acoustic instruments and rocking it out, that was still pretty new. And that's what kind of made it, you know, this big splash. So we knew what we were doing was really cool. We knew we loved it. And we knew because people were responding to it, both the Canadiana portion, and we'd have to remember, like, Peter Zosky was, like, our goals were, like, to be on Morningside, and we accomplished that. Our goals were, like, Stompin' Tom, you know, getting him out of retirement. That was really Dave Bedini's goal and the Rio Statics, but they accomplished that, and we got to play on a bill with the Stompin' Tom. So it was all those things. So I think for us it was just we loved the thing we were doing, and we just wanted to figure out how to do it and play festivals and tour and grow our, you know, fans.
Songs were really amazing, and I have to say that I'm a great admirer of how you sang those songs on the records. Like your vocal interpretations are just phenomenal.
Thank you. Well, I think Chuck had a good ear for what I could sing. I mean, thematically, that's a whole other conversation to be had in terms of how long it is now. Looking back on songs, as opposed to having been singing them. At the time, they were the right songs to be singing, and they were certainly suited where we were at and what we were sort of going for. Yeah.
You mentioned Willie P. Bennett. Was he kind of a part of that thing for you at the time?
No, he was kind of later. Mm-hmm. Got to know him a bit later. And when I left the band in 91, I hung around a little bit with Pat Temple and Willie P. Bennett. We played the Moose compilation event. I mean, it was put out at the Phoenix by then, I think? Was the Diamond still? I don't know. But Moose Records had a big show. And Willie P. and Pat Temple and I were a trio for one glorious night. We hung out a lot at that time anyway, but we did Sin City and this song they had both written called Tenderly and a third song I can't remember. It was just brilliant. But Willie P. was so... Oh my God, he was so wonderful. He's the only real mentor I've had in terms of writing, because I didn't write during the band. And when I left the band, I was very lost. I didn't know who I was, and I didn't know what the next thing was. And Willie and Pat were just like, well, you should write songs, like, and play more guitar and all that stuff. I didn't see it, you know. I was just kind of bit broken, whatever. So, but Willie was great because he would just show me his thesaurus and his office space and his process and talk about words. And we just throw words around at night. And I just like, well, yeah, that was really helpful for being a bit lost. It set me up really well to go to New Orleans, to be honest. Mm. To ultimately, like when I decided I had to blow Toronto and just go somewhere where I wasn't, hitting landmines all the time of who was in the past. It was great to go away somewhere, but I felt like I was ready to start really owning more of my skills, I guess.
You mentioned Moose Records, and for the listeners that might not be familiar with that, there are a whole bunch of bands that revolved around that label that were signed, quote-unquote, signed to that label. Can you talk a little bit about that whole scene?
Oh, I don't know. Can I? Well, it was basically, there were a lot of bands, and actually I'm going to blank on all sorts of the names that are on you have the compilation.
I should give you the compilation where it went to.
Sort of helpful, but because the acoustic roots scene was so big, people were trying all sorts of stuff. Oh my God. So who is on this? I can't read it really. Bob Snyder. Oh my God, these names are great. I would need a light. Can't see anything else, to be honest.
Yeah, this is the Moose Records compilation. I think Big Smoke, Positively Stompin', who are Mad
Lee
Love.
Wallace, Mad Love. Yeah. Really, it was just Lost and Profound. It was just anyone who in that scene who was, we were doing something so daring by playing this acoustic music. And also a bunch of us had gone up north on the train. We tried to save the rails in 89 or something. So we went from Toronto to North Bay to Cochrane and Kapuskasing. So a lot of those bands, like Steve and Steve, Positively Stomping, Rear Static, Skydiggers. Skydiggers were in that scene. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
And Grievous Angels also got signed to a different label. Was it Polydor, or am I making that up?
Lost and Profound got signed to Polydor. Okay. Polydor? Yeah. Not Polydor.
Polygram.
Polydor sounds.
I think there is a Polydor somewhere.
Yeah, we were signed to Stony Plain.
Stony Plain, right.
In Edmonton.
Right.
Yeah. An amazing, incredible label. Yeah. And I was a big proponent. I pushed for that over Polygram because I don't know what. In the last 2 years, I'd say of the band, there was an unrest and for me, a need to move to do something or a discomfort or whatever. When it came in the last year to the idea of signing with a label, I felt like Polygram would be a problem. It was too big, and I didn't feel like maybe I didn't think I was going to be around. I don't know. I can't. I can look back and guess at things. I also just felt like the smaller label, blues label, acoustic label out of Edmonton made way more sense for us. And it did. I mean, Holger Peterson, his label, it reflected a lot of things. Like we playing in Edmonton was a big thing for the Grievous Angels, and so it felt like the only way to move forward. So I'm always glad we did that.
When you left the band and went to New Orleans, what was that experience like for you and taking part of the music scene there?
Changed everything, absolutely everything. I left the band in 91, and then in 92 I went on a, you know how people go to Europe to find themselves at a certain point? I didn't. I took out a loan and I went to on a train trip on the city of New Orleans, but I went to Memphis, New Orleans. I went to Texas and I did the Kerrville Folk Festival. I camped there for a couple weeks, back to New Orleans, to Nashville. And in about a 6 week period, I went to Jazz Fest in New Orleans, so that was part of it. I had been to New Orleans when I was in my early 20s, so I'd always wanted to go back for Jazz Fest. And I think the breadth of music at Jazz Fest is what opened me up, and then there's something about that city. Rob Bresjany is an astrologer that has an astrology column. He has this line about how there are cities where you feel like you're more who you are. I don't always feel like I'm myself in Toronto, the city I love and I'm from, but in New Orleans, I always feel like I know who I am. And so it made sense to go try to figure out who I was down there. So I came back from the trip in the fall, September, and in February of 93, I just woke up and decided to figure out how to get to New Orleans. And 6 months later, I was there.
Did you hang out with different musicians or play with different bands when you were down there?
Yeah, you can't go a day without hearing live music if you leave your house. Absolutely, right? And I was lucky. The mid-90s in New Orleans was a very special time. So I'm writing about it right now, like as a memoir, because wow, we were lucky. Like there were still people. I got to go see this guy, Danny Barker. I sing his songs right now. Because, you know, I didn't know enough about my jazz history, but Danny Barker sure did. And he played with Louis Armstrong, and I got to see him play in the last kind of year of his life. And that blew me away. And there were also Preservation Hall. I would go see these, you know, the Humphrey Brothers or whomever, just feeling the tradition of music. And then I'd go to mostly parades is what my thing was. Like I lived around Frenchman Street, which now people understand is a huge street. But back then I couldn't tell people about the Treme. I couldn't tell people about Frenchman Street and have them understand it. Now, thank God, there's just so much out there. People understand these are just incredible neighborhoods. So for me, it was just one parade after another, and it was sort of waking me up. And I would start playing, I started playing solo gigs down there and writing, obviously, a little bit. But I was hanging with the you know, All-Star Klezmer Band, who were, you know, doing their thing, and then the kind of rock bands. At that time, you know, there was a lot of the jazz and brass band stuff. And then the songwriter thing wasn't as big. You know, like back then, like I would just hear a lot of you know, drum beats that were always just all over the place. And I love that. That's why I was there. But eventually I was sort of like, I want to hear something square. And I just want to hear someone tell a song. And that doesn't happen enough down there. So I went down there to shake everything up. And it did. It shook me up.
Wow. Fantastic.
And I came home because that was enough time in America, I think.
Just before we wrap up, Michelle, and it's been great talking with you. We're going to play a couple songs from your 2019 album, Years Behind. I'm wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about that album and the songs we're going to be listening to.
Sure. Make a List is just a fun little resolution song. Recorded this just before the pandemic, really, like the year before. It went out 2019. Got to go to New Orleans in January. Just before the pandemic. It was recorded live with someone I've worked with, produced by Kevin Quain. I've worked with him on all three of my records. Great producer, great, brilliant artist. Two of the songs on the record are his. Can't say enough about how people should know Kevin Quain's name. And it was done more live than not live at Union Sound in Toronto with Nigel Hellboy and Adam Warner as the bass band. And it was the live part of it. And I loved it. It was a great experience.
Michelle, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been great. I feel we could talk for another 20 minutes at least.
Yeah, I'm sorry if I was rambling, but yeah.
Yeah. And for the listeners, we hope you've enjoyed today's show with Toronto-based singer-songwriter Michelle Rumble. For more information on Michelle and her music, please check out her website, www.michellerumble, spelled RUMBALL.com, or her Facebook page. The two songs, as we've mentioned in our interview, are Make a List and Hope from her 2019 recording, Years Behind. I'm Barry Livingston. Thanks for listening.
Running out of running rooms, waiting for my life to show, forgetting all about my love, seeing just how much I know. Flatlands here I can see. Try hard, but you can't catch me. I've been traveling this prairie. The storm clouds overseeing me. I've been driving for days. For weeks in my mind.
could I forget? It would take this much time. The blue note fading from my mind. Driving too hard to dance with time. Why ever thought
gone, but lip serves don't need to dawn for too long.